history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some incredible stories waiting to be told. There are seemingly ordinary Americans with extraordinary experiences, and each week we get the privilege of meeting them. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. General term applied to anyone who was on the island of Oahu on December 7th, 1941, which includes Hickam Field, and that's where today's guest Ed Hall was 75 years ago. But Ed, let's talk about before you went out to the islands, because that's a long way from where you grew up. Now, I want to get this straight. You were born in Greenville, South Carolina, but you grew up in Greenwood, South Carolina? And isn't there a Greenburg somewhere in there, too?
No, there's a Greensboro, North Carolina. It's the only one I know.
That's true. Greensboro, for sure. So what was life like as a kid growing up in South Carolina? What do you remember about those days?
Mostly, I remember I had to work my little butt off because our family was rather poor. And although we did not live on a farm, where we lived, there was practically no zoning laws whatsoever. We had a cow and chickens in the backyard. At one time, we had a mule because my dad had 38 acres of land about 3 miles out of the city limits. As a kid, I had quite a few chores. We didn't have grass in the backyard. It was all dirt. We had pecan trees, peach trees, apple trees. And, of course, in the fall when those leaves all fell, that was my job. Clean them up. Harvest the pecans. Harvest the fruit. And my sister, she had to take care of the chickens and milk the cow. And Dad ran a bread truck. He sold bread and cakes to the different stores around town. And my job, after he came from the railroad station every morning with a fresh load of products, I was 9 years old, and I had to unload the truck. The boxes weighed about 20, 25 pounds. And then I had to unload and stock everything in the garage, take an inventory, and then reload the truck the way he wanted every item situated. And lo and behold, if I got one item mislocated, it was my little butt. So that was about my childhood until I was 16 years old. And I flunked out of high school, and I joined the service.
Well, it sounds like you had that military discipline at home a long time before you ever wore a uniform. And I've got to ask you, in those years, as you're working so hard and following all these rules and doing all this hard work, did you have some ambitions? Did you have some dreams of, hey, someday I'm going to do X, Y, Z?
No, not really. I was always concentrating, trying to keep out of trouble so my dad wouldn't be beating up on my little rear end. I was a mischievous child, I must say. And I did get in a lot of trouble, and I did deserve a lot of the lickings I got. But there were some that I didn't deserve, too, because Dad was a strict disciplinarian, very much so.
And you mentioned dropping out of high school and joining the service, but you weren't old enough to get in the service.
Well, of course, I had to lie about my age. My parents did sign for me, so I was allowed to go in.
So your parents went along with the lie? They said you were 17 when you were 16? Is that what it was?
Yeah.
So it sounds like the feeling was mutual. They were ready for you to take off somewhere too, huh?
Well, yes and then no. Then my mother told me later when I came home, your dad was very depressed after you left. A month or so after you left, he went in kind of a depression, and it took him a little while to get out of it. Then when I came home, he was glad to see me.
I know that's a long time ago, and a lot of things have happened since, but do you remember what your expectations of military life were, what you thought you were getting into?
Not really. I just knew I was going to be in a place where discipline was rather enforced, but fairly. Of course, I had ambitions of advancing in grade and so forth, which, again, I ran into a few problems of my own making. Of course, I did have a run-in with a commanding officer one time.
Only once?
Well, one big one, let's put it that way. And that kind of nullified my whole career.
Well, I'm sure everybody wants to hear that story now that you teased us with it.
Well, really, there's not much to it. I was accused of being AWOL, which I wasn't. The commanding officer and I got into quite a discussion, and I used some foul language, and I told him what I thought of him, and that ended my career.
Was that still here in the States before you went over to Hawaii?
Oh, no, that was in Hawaii after the war started.
And we're going to hear about the day the war started. But before that, you must have been living the dream. Here you go from all this hard work in South Carolina. You join the Army, and they send you out to this beautiful paradise called Oahu. What was that adjustment like for you?
Oh, let me tell you, that was great. When we arrived in Hawaii, I was stationed downtown at Fort Armstrong. It was a quartermaster base. We issued all supplies to all the different Army posts around Oahu. And, of course, that was a lot of work, but that was pleasurable. You know, you were working to accomplish something and support your whole Army, so to speak. And I felt rather proud being a part of that. And, of course, that was in peacetime, and promotions were very slow in coming. As a matter of fact, I never got one. Till I transferred out to Hickam Fields a year or so later. But I enjoyed being downtown Honolulu and about a 25-minute walk from Waikiki Beach. And I mean, it was a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people would be curious to know what that was like, because 75 years later, of course, we know Waikiki Beach and all of Honolulu and how urbanized it is and how tourist-driven it is. But back in 1941, how different was it?
Well, it was very different because in Waikiki Beach, they only had two principal hotels on the beach, Royal Hawaiian and the Moana Hotel. And they used to do a radio show on the beach at the Moana Hotel under the big banyan tree. It was a huge, huge banyan tree. I don't remember the radio announcer's name, but Hawaii Calls was the name of the program every Saturday afternoon. That was a pleasure to be there if you were off that day and you could get there. That was a lot of fun. But we had a lot of fun all over that island. We had beaches on the other side. My favorite beach was at Makapu Point.
So was that a pretty carefree life, would you say, before the war? Did you have any idea that anything like this was coming?
Oh, of course not. We were living the life of ease and pleasure and joy. I just can't tell you how beautiful and how wonderful it was to be in Hawaii before the war started.
And I guess, I know it's a cliche, but I've got to ask you, did the kid from South Carolina learn how to surf on Waikiki Beach?
No, I tried it once and I got my chest all skinned up and I said, nah, I don't think I want to do this anymore.
You didn't want the wahine to see those scars on your chest, huh?
No, but I'll tell you one thing we used to do. The surf out at the beach at Makapu Point, those waves would come in 8 and 10 feet high at times, and we had one heck of a wind out there. So we couldn't afford surfboards. They were too expensive. They cost, what, $10? I don't remember. But anyway, we used to take mattress covers. Now, some people don't know what a mattress cover in the Army is. It was a big bag, and your mattress went inside the bag. But we used to take those bags out to the beach, hold them up to the wind, fill them up with air, and tie it down real quick, and then swim out 50 or a couple of hundred feet, catch a wave and come flying in, laying across that mattress cover. And we were like, skiing? And here again, I hit that sand one day, got all bruised up again.
Now that sounds like a reenactment I'd like to see someday. There's a lot of things people reenact from that time in history. I don't think I've ever seen that. Would you be up for it?
Today, at my age, are you kidding?
Well, and I want to get to December 7th, but I guess it's also important to point out you had enlisted and there was a time period that you were expecting to stay in the service. When were you thinking, hey, I'm going to be out of uniform and go back to civilian life?
I enlisted in 1939, and when you enlisted in those days, you enlisted for 3 years. And if you asked for duty overseas, you only had to serve 2 years overseas. Come home and you could take a discharge, or you could re-enlist and continue on with your service. So I never really had that choice. Between Sergeant and myself, we pulled a little gag on the commanding officer that we had at that time, who was a real good Joe. So it was in May of 1942. And if it had been peacetime, I would have been on my way home. But the war, of course, kept me there. And I knew I was going to have to stay. There was no question about that. But we cooked it up. The company clerk, who was the sergeant, and I, he gave me permission to go in and see the old man. So I walked in, saluted, told him who I was. And he says, I have a request, sir. And he says, what is that request? I said, well, really more of a question. My 2 years is up overseas. When am I going to go home? Well, he slammed his hand on the desk, stood up quick enough that his chair fell over backwards. And he says, get the hell out of here. He says, you're being held for the convenience of the government for the duration of the hostilities, and I don't want to hear any more about it. Get out. But then when I laughed, he realized it was a joke. So we both had a good laugh over it.
I'm glad you had a laugh and not a demotion or some demerits on your file. So you would have been out in May of 42 had December 7th not happened, but December 7th did happen. What kinds of things were you doing at Hickam Field before that happened? And can you explain for everybody listening who maybe has never been there or doesn't know the layout where Hickam Field is and what its importance was at the time?
Well, Hickam Field is roughly about 12 miles, and that's a guess because I never did really know exactly how far, but roughly about 12 miles from downtown Honolulu, and it's right next to Pearl Harbor. Hickam Field and Pearl Harbor share the same banks of Pearl Harbor, if you want to look at it that way. As a matter of fact, the Officers Club at Hickam Field sits right on, I call it a peninsula. It's just at the entrance of Pearl Harbor where all the ships come in. And there's the Officers Club in Hickam Field sitting there. One side of it, you can see Pearl Harbor. Then if you look west, you see the Pacific Ocean. It's right there. And it's a beautiful location. It's a beautiful place. Of course, today, the Air Force and the Navy are a co-command now and has been for quite a few years now.
But not back then. Was there a little rivalry between you guys wearing the Army uniforms and those guys in the Navy blues?
Oh, yeah, and the Marines. And I got a little joke about that. You see, we always said, the Army does the work, the Navy got the pay, and the Marines got the credit. Of course, the Marines don't like to hear that, but
I'm sure they have some good comebacks for that, too. So before December 7th, you're assigned to Hickam Field. What kinds of duties did you have? What was the work you were doing day to day?
I was a truck driver, but there was a situation came up, an opportunity for me to make a few extra bucks. And that was, if I would go in and do all the KP with a couple other guys, we would all get paid extra money. So on Sunday morning, December the 7th, that's what we were doing. My buddy and I, we were preparing the mess hall. As a matter of fact, we weren't serving food in the mess hall. We were redecorating, getting ready for Christmas. And we had an air compressor. We were going to spray paint the place. And we had a fellow in the carpenter shop. He made outlines of every state in the Union of which we had a member from that state to honor them. We had a field stove that us guys that were working in the mess hall could have breakfast or lunch or whatever. So my buddy Alex says, well, listen, Ed, First Sergeant and all of his gang had to be in here last night, and they took food out of the walk-in refrigerator. They messed up every pot and pan in the place. We can't even make breakfast unless we clean up something. Now, you clean us a frying pan. I'll start the air compressor, and I'll light up the field stove, and we can have breakfast. I said, okay. So I'm back by the sink scrubbing out this frying pan. And Alex had started the air compressor. I heard it running. And then all of a sudden, I heard, boom. I looked around at that air compressor. What's wrong with that thing? I turned back around and continued scrubbing the pan. And another whoomp. And I looked at that thing, and then I heard the darndest explosion you'd ever want to hear in your life. Now I thought something blew up outside.
And of course, he would go outside to investigate. When we come back, we're going to find out what Ed saw, what happened next, and why he looks back at three incidents over the harrowing minutes that followed and believes that his life was spared. Find photos and a little video of Ed at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with soon-to-be 93-year-old Ed Hall of Las Vegas, Nevada, originally from South Carolina. And on December 7th, 1941, an 18-year-old at Oahu's Hickam Field, adjacent to Pearl Harbor. When we left off, Ed told us about being in a mess hall there and hearing an explosion unlike anything he had ever heard before. Once he went outside, he would be seeing things he never would have imagined.
I ran to the back door, looked up Hangar Avenue. Hangars 7 and 9 had blown up and debris was flying everywhere. And I thought, my God, an airplane exploded in one of the hangars? And then about that time, Hangar 2 and 4 was right across the street from me. The entrance was in line with the door where I was standing. Guys were running out of the hangar, scattering all over everywhere. And then I saw puffs of asphalt kicking up. What the hey? And then I saw this plane coming across the runway the wrong way. Holy mackerel, who's this idiot? And then I realized that's gunfire. And this plane is coming right at me. And this guy is so low, he couldn't have been more than 25, 30 feet off the ground. but he had to pull up the Mr. Building and the electrical wires that were outside. That's what saved my life, because he was coming straight at me. As he flew over, I looked up. He was looking down at me, and I was looking up at him, and he had a big smile on his face. I mean, that's how close he was. And I could see him. So then I went running out, hollering for Alex, "Where is everybody?" Well, they had all disappeared. Oh, I got to tell you one other. As I turned around, before I could yell at Alex, I decided I got to hide someplace. Where, oh, the kitchen sink. So I dived under the kitchen sink. And things seemed to quiet down just for a second or so, and that's when I got out, started yelling for Alex, and I ran outside, and now I'm still in awe. I'm staring out in the air and looking at all these planes flying around. And one guy reaches out from under the eave of a building, grabs me by the shoulder, curses me out, "You're going to get killed, get under here." And I didn't more than get under the eave of that building. Here comes another plane strafing, took off about 2 inches of that edge of that building, number two.
Second time your life was saved.
Second time. So now this is the hick with the mess hall. I got to get down to the motor pool because I know they're going to need drivers. So I go down there, and I was told to take a truck and go up Hangar Avenue and do whatever I could to help out. Well, it always, even to this day, it seems a mystery to me how this happened. But as I got up near the hangars, it had exploded, which was right across the street was the big barracks. And the guy come running out, waving his hands, "Stop, stop, I need you, I need you." I said, "Who are you?" He said, "I'm a medic, we got wounded. We got to get them to the hospital." So that's what I did for the rest of the day. And then we took a load over to the hospital, came back over on Hangar Avenue, and went in between the hangars, picking up wounded. I picked up one dead lieutenant, and he had a .45 automatic. I figured, well, his guts are spilled all over it. He don't need it. So I took his .45 and never cleaned that belt either. And still had blood on it the day I had to turn it in when I came back to the States. But I believe it was the second, or could have been the third trip that we made. We got strafed again. The tires were shot out on the truck, and we had bullets come between him and myself through the cab that just missed both of us. Actually, we didn't realize that until we stopped and picked up another wounded. Well, we stopped when the tires went flat. Not to pick up a wounded, really, but there was wounded there. And as he got out, went to shut the door, he says, "My God, Ed, look at the holes in the roof." I looked at him, "My Lord, where the..." And then I realized the tires had been shot out, and these dang gun bullets came through the roof of the cab, number three. Well, that was my three close calls for the day. So the rest of the next 2 or 3 hours, we were still roaming around looking for wounded. I couldn't tell you how many people we picked up that were wounded.
Are we talking like dozens?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, at least. And I believe I just knew these fellows. I can't say they were friends, but they were acquaintances. Leonard Beasley, Eugene Denson, and Robert Kelly. Now, Robert Kelly I knew real well. They were killed that day, those three. All three of them belonged to the 42nd Bomb Squadron. The rest of my tour during the war was spent in Air Corps Supply. I transferred to Air Corps Supply, and I spent the rest of the war as a supply person throughout the Pacific. So that's about the extent of December the 7th, 41.
Well, I've got a few questions to ask you about all that, and I think a lot of people can feel and understand a little more what it must have been like from hearing your description. But I'm curious, that first moment, I mean, you described hearing those explosions while you're in the mess hall, but then when you come out and you see an airplane and it's coming right at you and you see these explosions and this debris flying all around, what did you think was happening? Because nobody knows a war is coming. I mean, had you even considered the possibility that someone could attack you there on Hawaii?
Not at all. It was the furthest thing from our minds. That was the most surprising and devastating day I've ever spent in my life. People just don't realize the feeling that you have, which is actually no feeling at the very moment that it's happening. And then all of a sudden it dawns on you. Then it doesn't fully hit you until, like it didn't really hit me until about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon after the attack was all over with. And I realized what I had done in picking up wounded and the dead as to how devastating this attack was. Now, there was another thing that I saw, and I didn't know at the time, from where we were. As I said, the edge of the building was shut off, the roof. At that point, as I ran out, I saw this huge explosion from Pearl Harbor. I didn't know it then, but that was the Arizona exploding. See, this all happened. Everything that I'm telling you happened in less than 10 minutes. It didn't take very long, believe me. It all happened so fast. And then, of course, the explosion of the Shaw was another one. I could see the smoke, and I heard the explosion, but I didn't know what had happened at Pearl. But I found out later that was the Arizona. Oh, by the way, speaking of the Arizona, there's one thing a lot of people may not know, that there is 1,177 sailors still in that ship. They were never recovered simply because there was too much going on for the next few days, preparing defenses, trying to repair ships that could be repaired. The powers that be thought the bodies were secondary. Don't worry about it. Do it later. But then after a while, they decided they would just leave the bodies there as a memorial, and that's what happened. Of course, now I think everybody knows that today, any survivor of the Arizona who passes away can have his ashes reburied in the Arizona if he so desires. A lot of people don't know that.
Well, and I want to hear eventually about your experiences going back there and visiting the Arizona and Hickam Field and everything there. But back on December 7th, I'm just trying to get a feel for this. So you're 18 years old. Your world has just changed. The whole world has just changed. But you mentioned it, no feeling, that sense of shock and some kind of numbness that you can't feel. It's so extreme that you can't even feel it at first. So you're going. You're driving this truck. You're picking up dead bodies. You're picking up the wounded. How far was that trip to the hospital from where you were?
Anywhere from 4 to about 6 or 7 blocks.
And as you make these trips back and forth, does it ever strike you that you're putting yourself in danger by doing that?
No, I never thought about that. All I thought about was trying to get help to people. I never even thought about the risk that I might be taking. Cecil Jacobs and I, we were both, we just couldn't understand what was happening, really. And we were too scared to be scared, if you follow what I mean. We just did what we thought we had to do. People that needed help.
I guess when you get out of the truck and you see the tires are shot out and then there's bullets in the cab between where the two of you are sitting, it kind of hits home that that you were in danger. But when did you grasp the magnitude of what happened, the scope of what happened, and the reality that this is war?
Oh, that must have been 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon when things did calm down somewhat. I mean, the attack was over and all of that. The attack actually was over about, 10:20, 10:30? The second wave finished and they left.
But you guys don't know that. It's not like they gave you a signal, said, hey, it's over now. You don't know if anything else is coming.
No, we didn't know. We were still anticipating. Every time a plane, even ours, would fly over, we know, oh, God, here they come again. And, of course, you know, we shot down, I believe it was 6 of our own planes that night, and that was a scary thing. We thought it was going to be an invasion now. That was a very scary time. Once you realized what had happened and your thoughts got together and you realized, my God, we're at war. We've been attacked. I was damn near killed. Oh, my God, what else is going to happen? Are they coming back again? It was a frightening situation, especially that night.
And can you paint a picture for us of just at Hickam Field, the devastation that occurred there and the contrast between what Hickam looked like before the attack and in the aftermath?
Well, Hickamfield was one of the most beautiful bases I have ever seen in my life. It was new. It wasn't even completed yet. Now, I'm guessing. I really don't know. But from what I remember, that base was about 70% complete. There were supposed to be 20 hangars, and there was 3 and 5. Why there was 3 and 5, I've never been able to find out. There was 3 and 5, 7 and 9, 11 and 13, 15 and 17. And that was on the west end of the base, or the west half. And on the eastern half, the mountainside half, there was supposed to be hangars, and there was number 2 and number 4. Then there was supposed to be 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, and 20. I may be wrong on the numbers, but anyway, I know there was hangars 2 and 4, and there was supposed to be more. Then we had the million-dollar barracks, they called it, because it did cost just a little over $1 million to build that beautiful building. There was 9 wings, 3 stories high, and those barracks were absolutely devastated. They were bombed and strafed, and the marks are still in the building. They'll never be repaired. They're preserved there, too, as a remembrance of December the 7th, 41. And that building was so badly damaged that they could only reuse, if my memory serves me right, the first 2 floors. The top floors were, for the most part, were rendered useless. But that was one beautiful building. Then you had in front of that building the most beautiful parade ground. And that parade ground ran toward Pearl Harbor. And there was a main street. Then there was the headquarters building. And on the other side of the headquarters building, still going toward Pearl Harbor, was another beautiful parade ground. And at that parade ground, on the right, going toward Pearl Harbor, you had houses, homes, that for what we call the first 3 grades of the enlisted men, that would be master sergeants, tech sergeants, staff sergeants. And then on the left side were beautiful homes for the high-ranking officers, the generals, the colonels, and then behind that were individual homes for officers on the left and enlisted personnel on the right, married personnel. It was one beautiful build, beautiful, beautiful base. And I went back. I'm not sure what year it was that they turned that beautiful parade ground in front of the building, turned it into a parking lot. That broke my heart. That broke my heart. That was such a beautiful area.
Well, I think the first to mess with that beauty and disrupt that peace would have been the Japanese that morning. And so you're looking at all this, and you see destroyed hangars, shot up runways, the barracks decimated. What does that do to you and your fellow airmen emotionally to see that, to witness that?
Mostly it made us all mad as hell. Oh, the cursing that went on, and oh, man, we really had a field day cursing those people. To me, I wouldn't buy a Japanese car on a bet. I'm still American-made, man, and I just can't understand people buying all these foreign cars, and I hope you're not driving one.
I'll plead the 5th right now. Don't want this interview to end just yet. So you've seen what happened at Hickam. And you mentioned, without knowing what it was, you saw the explosion of the Arizona and then that magazine just blowing everything in the air on the Shaw. At what point did you actually see the aftermath of what had happened there next door at Pearl Harbor?
Oh, that took a while because we were busy in our own place there trying to get things squared away. And I just can't tell you. Our trucking company, we worked our butts off. As a matter of fact, it was 3.5 days before I ever got into a bed. I caught naps in the trucks while they were loading, unloading, or whatever. I'd catch a little nap. But it had to be at least 3 days before I ever crawled into a bed itself.
And what were you guys doing that whole time?
Mostly cleaning up. For instance, now we had to move all of the food that was salvageable from the big mess hall. Oh, by the way, there's something interesting. There was a mess hall, the dining area, was so big, you could have actually put 6 basketball courts in it. And it was devastated. It was ruined. There was 14 people killed in the mess hall. 8 of them were cooks that had ran into a walk-in refrigerator for protection, and it was a victim of a direct hit, and concussion killed them. They had no wounds on them, just the concussion killed them. And that kitchen and that whole mess hall was just absolutely devastated. Couldn't use it anymore. As a matter of fact, they made a gymnasium out of it.
We need to take our last break, but we'll get the rest of Ed's December 7th story when we get back, plus what trips back to Pearl Harbor and to Washington, D.C. and the World War II Memorial have meant to him. Find his smiling face at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, and we'll be right back after this. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com. If you're a regular listener to Hometown Heroes, it is hard to forget the story of Jimmy Weldon, or as so many of us first heard him, the voice of that little duck on the Yogi Bear show, Yakky Doodle.
Help! Chopper! Chopper, they're after me!
Run, little feller!
I'm running!
Yakky, now that you're safe, tell me, where's your mama?
I know that, no mama. Would you be my mama?
Yep, even in his 90s, he can still do that voice. And you can see and hear for yourself at a special lunch with Jimmy Weldon on Thursday, October 20th in Clovis, California. Maybe you grew up with Uncle Jimmy Weldon and Webster Webfoot on TV in places like Bakersfield, Monterey, Salinas, or Fresno. You'll be amazed at his journey from World War II in Europe all the way to Hollywood and everywhere in between. And you'll be moved by just how much he loves our country. Thursday, October 20th from noon to 1:30 at the Clovis Veterans Memorial District building, a lunch you'll never forget with the one and only Jimmy Weldon. For tickets, go to cbmcfresno.com or call 559-225-5095. That number again, 559-225-5095. I'll be there, and I hope to see you there, October 20th in Clovis.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Loeffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's visit in Vegas with almost 93-year-old Ed Hall, an Army Air Corps veteran of World War II. He was there the day America was drawn into the war, and he told us about 3 close calls he had at Hickam Field on Oahu that morning. From that first trip he made in a truck taking wounded to the base hospital, Ed was going almost nonstop for more than 3 days. So for those 3.5 days afterwards, you're moving food, you're moving supplies, you're cleaning up. Yeah. The debris, rubble.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it all had to be cleaned up. Somebody had to do it. And, of course, we were the only trucking company on the base. I think we had about 20 or 25 trucks, 2.5-tonners, a few pickups, and a few ton-and-a-halves. But they were all busy. We were busy day and night for about 3 or 4 days.
You mentioned for us a little bit ago the names of 3 guys you knew that were killed at Hickam that day. Do you remember when you found out about that and what that was like for an 18-year-old kid to know these buddies are gone?
I know I was talking to somebody and they told me Kelly was killed. I don't guess I found out about the others until some years later. When I went back to Hickam the first time, they had the monument by the flagpole, and they heard the names on the killed in action. That's when I found out about the other two.
You mentioned the flagpole. That's one of the iconic images of December 7th. Here's a rendering of it right here on a program from a memorial service. You see the smoke from the barracks in the background. Yep. And that flagpole towering over the scene with the stars and stripes flying amidst the smoke. When you look at that image, what comes to mind?
The horrible day and the beautiful flag defending this country as a symbol, it makes me proud. The flag of this country makes me proud every time I see it. Mm-hmm. I'm ready to choke up now.
No, that's all right. Well, there aren't too many people who found out about Pearl Harbor the way you did, by Japanese shooting at you. Most of the country found out the next day when the president addressed the nation and gave that famous Day of Infamy speech. If you were going nonstop in that truck for 3 days, am I thinking you didn't get to hear that speech at the time?
Nope. I was too busy.
I'm sure you've heard it since.
Oh, yeah.
When you hear FDR going through that list of things that happened and what it means and what we're going to do now, what comes to mind for you?
What a great country this is, and actually what a great President Roosevelt was at the time. He gave us all an inspiration that we were going to win this war. There was no doubt about it. Well, we knew that before he ever made the speech, but any country could be foolish enough to attack the United States of America at that time, and even today, they got rocks in their head.
Well, and that was the first day of the war. You were supposed to be out of the service 6 months later, but that didn't happen, the duration of the hostilities. So what did you do for the rest of World War II? You had another almost 4 years to go there.
Well, they shoved me around all over the Pacific doing my warehouse thing, supplies. Now, I was at a place called the Phoenix Islands, which very few people have ever heard of, and Marshall Islands. And I was sent down to the New Hebrides one time, but that was only a two-week stint for inventory of the different air bases down in that area. That was about what I did. The whole rest of the war was in supply.
And sorry, I'm bouncing around, but back on the 7th, there are a lot of things about that day. There are a lot of what-ifs. There are a lot of fortunate things that happened that day as much as the tragedy that unfolded. And a lot of that has to do with Pearl Harbor, but even at Hickam, the Japanese bombed a baseball field, but they didn't think they were bombing a baseball field. Tell us that story, because that definitely affects what people were able to do after the attack.
Okay. It seems that the Japanese had quite a few maps of everything in the islands. There were a few that they did not have correct maps. For instance, the officers' club, they knew, was in the basement of the base operations tower, so they didn't bomb that. They didn't bother to strafe it. If they did, it was by accident. But the aviation fuel storage area was supposed to be in one place, and this is the map that the Japanese had. However, at the last minute, so to speak, they changed the aviation gasoline storage area to another place and made a baseball field out of what would have been the fuel storage. Well, the Japanese bombed the baseball field and just tore it all to pieces. So we all thought that was rather amusing. But then there was one other thing that happened. Down in the wooden barracks area, we had the enlisted men's beer garden. It was nicknamed the Snake Ranch because it seemed like when all the guys were drinking all night long, they had to crawl to their barracks. So it was nicknamed the Snake Ranch. And others say it was nicknamed because people got so drunk they saw snakes. But I like the Snake Ranch crawling away better. But anyway, it was a victim of a direct hit. Our first sergeant, when he saw that, he let out a stream of curse words that was a mile long. And he says, "They destroyed my beer garden." And he was really upset about that because he did love his beer. The beer garden was absolutely destroyed. But you should have seen the guys later after things kind of quieted down. And those guys, especially the Air Force guys, they had nothing to do. So they were raiding what was left of the beer garden.
Uh-huh.
So that was quite a scene also.
So the rest of the war, you mentioned you're sent to different places throughout the Pacific, all the time working in supply, but all the time around these guys who are flying bombers and fighters, guys who are on the bomber crews. What kind of respect and esteem do you have for guys who served in an Army Air Corps at that time that was pretty primitive? A lot of these things had never been done before, and they didn't know what these planes were capable of, how dangerous they were. How much respect and admiration do you have for those guys who put their lives on the line that way?
There's no way to express my feelings of those air crews. The dangers that they went through, the wounds and the psychological sufferings that they experienced, there's not enough admiration in the world for those guys. Absolutely a great bunch of men. When you consider you had to fly, especially in Europe, you had to fly 25 missions in order to be able to come home if you made it alive. And there was very few crews that finished the war on a B-17 together.
For you personally, you described three times the first day of the war where it so easily could have been you, and your name would have been added to that list that you honor every year on December 7th. What about the rest of the war? Were there any situations that you found yourself in that you look back on now and say, yeah, you know, I came pretty close there too?
No, not really. Down in New Hebrides Islands and the Phoenix Islands, we experienced some nighttime bombing, but nothing close where I might have been in danger. Actually, all they were doing were flying over, dropping a few bombs on the runways or wherever they could. But mostly they were taking pictures. They were photographic Japanese planes. So they didn't really do any big damage. Down in the New Hebrides, I understand they did a lot of damage before I got there. A lot of people were killed. But when I was there, we got bombed a few times. But my experience was nothing like the 7th of December, not even close.
I'm sure there's at least one other date in the war that brings back some memories for you. VJ Day, when Japan surrendered. Do you remember hearing about that or what that meant to you?
Well, yeah, I finally thought, well, they got what they had coming and even more for what they did. I just can't get over that sneak attack. And then again, I can't get over a lot of the faults of this country for not being alert enough to protect us, to protect that fleet there at Pearl Harbor. All the mistakes that was made that day, and any one mistake had not been made, the outcome of that attack could have been a lot different. But that's the way things went. As they say, that's the way the ball bounced.
And who knows, maybe that sleeping giant wouldn't have woken up if it hadn't been as severe and devastating as it was. Now, I understand that this was something you didn't talk about for a long time as you came back to the States and lived in Chicago for a long time, working on elevators and all those sky rises there. But you moved here to Las Vegas a little more than 20 years ago. And that's when you first joined the Pearl Harbor Survivors Association, was here in Vegas?
No, I had joined a group in the Chicago area, but they weren't quite as active as our chapter here in Las Vegas. Here in Vegas, we tried to go to schools and inform the history class of what happened that day and our experiences.
Why is that important to you?
Because I think history in this country is very important, very, very important. I know when I went to school, at grammar school, we had a history teacher. She was an older lady, and when I say old, I do mean old. She taught my father. She was a fantastic teacher, and I just loved history. I follow the history of this country, and I just cannot understand why the Board of Education throughout the United States is not throwing more emphasis on the history of this country that should be taught in schools, which they are not teaching.
With regard to December 7th, most of the world alive today wasn't alive 75 years ago. So if you want to share something about that history with the people listening right now, what do you think is the most important thing for people to understand?
There's a lot of things that people should understand about this country and its history. The founding of this country is number one, of course. The fact that the British tried again in 1812 and were defeated, but they came close. I think that history should be embedded in the pupils of the schools today. The political situation in this country, the history of the politics should be studied. People should understand the politics, the privileges of being a politician, and also the faults of politicians, and try to weed out those that are not deserving. I love this country, but I'm at an age now that actually the way this country is going, the way the politicians have treated this country, I'm glad I'm not going to be here too much longer to suffer what is going to happen in this country if somebody doesn't step up to the plate and look at what's wrong with this country and try to straighten it out.
Are you declaring your candidacy?
I just might vote for none of the above.
You've been back to Oahu many times. What is that like for you, to go back to Hickam Field and see those bullet holes that are still there, or to go to Pearl Harbor and see those tiers of oil coming up from the Arizona to read all those names? What is that like for you?
Well, to those that you just mentioned, it chokes me up. And I really have a hard time, even right now, I have a hard time keeping the tears back. When I think about all the guys that passed away and people I knew that were so hurt and lost their lives, it really gets hard for me at times.
Have you ever found yourself looking at those kinds of things, contemplating those realities and wondering, why wasn't it me? How close did I come to being one of those names?
Oh, yeah, I've thought about how close it came that I might have been one of them. And I hate to say it, but I rejoice that I wasn't. I think any man that escapes death and war has to feel good about himself. And I've heard people say, why couldn't it have been me? Why did it have to be him? Well, I personally don't feel that way. I was there. I did what I had to do. And I think I did my part. And I survived. And I'm happy I survived.
I don't know if a mathematician could assign odds to having those three close calls in that short of a time period, what the odds are surviving all three of those. But what do you make of that? Do you have an explanation as to how and why you made it through all of that?
No, the only thing I can say is the good Lord up above took care of me that day. And he's taken care of me all of these years that I'm still here and enjoying fairly decent health. And I'm thankful for that every day.
Is there something that you would say you're most proud of?
Other than I served my country at a time of its need, no, there's nothing else I can say.
I think that's something to be very proud of. And another experience that you've had that a lot of veterans have had across this country, and it's an ongoing effort, the Honor Flight Network flying veterans back to Washington, D.C. to see the World War II Memorial that wasn't finished until 2004. You had that opportunity. What did that experience mean to you?
That's hard to express. The feeling of sympathy, loneliness, the fact that I lost some friends during the war. When I see those columns at that memorial, it represents each state. And I think of the guys that I served with and from the different states that they were from and how well they served their country too. I just have a great, wonderful feeling that we all did it together. That monument was the most astounding thing I have ever seen. That wall with all those gold stars on it. And if my memory serves me right, each star represents 1,000 men killed in World War II. I forget the number of stars, but there's thousands of them.
Represents 406,000 Americans who died.
I knew it was up there somewhere along there. I couldn't remember the exact figure, but that was a wonderful, wonderful trip. And to those who initiated and produced that monument, my heartfelt thanks.
Well, that's my cue. I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving. Thank you for telling us your story and helping us understand December 7th from your perspective. Is there anything else that you think people need to know and people need to remember?
Just to remember, this is the greatest country that there ever was. And if somebody doesn't do something that has the power and the know-how to change it, I am deathly afraid this country is not going to be around much longer. Come on, Americans. Make this country survive and great again, as it always has been.
How's that for a challenge to wrap up our time today? One thing I appreciate about all these veterans we meet is that they never hold back. They tell us exactly how they really feel. That is Ed Hall of Las Vegas, Nevada. Find photos and videos of Ed at hometownheroesradio.com or on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And join us again next time for another Pearl Harbor survivor and his incredible story. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.